Hello to our wonderful fans and welcome back to Miss On Send with Xavier and Alan, where, as always, we'll be looking at all manner of film and theatre from around the world. Now, remember to follow us on your favourite listening platform as well as on Facebook or Instagram to get sneak peeks at upcoming episodes. This week, we're going head-to-head, though, as we look at 2021's Godzilla vs. Kong. So let's get smashing. Hi, Alan.
Hello, Save, and of course, hello to our favourite fans. Welcome back to Mise en Scène. Before we start to enter into a one-on-one battle with these epic kaijus and assert our dominance, a gentle reminder as always, guys, our podcasts are best enjoyed if you have seen the film prior, as we contain spoilers. As Save said, this week we're looking at Godzilla vs. Kong, which is a 2021 action-packed film directed by Adam Wingard, and the screenplay is by Eric Pearson and Max Bronstein, who also wrote the first film in the series. Now, the film stars Alexander Skarsgård, Millie Bobby Brown, Rebecca Hall, Brian Tyree Henry, and Sean Aguri, among many others. So to give our listeners a brief overview, I'll just provide a quick summary of the plot before breaking it down. The film takes place 5 years after Godzilla defeated King Ghidorah, and Kong is monitored by Monarch within this giant dome on Skull Island. Bernie Hayes, an employee of Apex Cybernetics and the host of Titan Conspiracy Theory podcast, extracts data suggesting sinister activities. At the same time, Godzilla suddenly attacks the facility. During the rampage, Bernie stumbles upon this massive device, which turns out to be a giant eye of Mechagodzilla. Madison Russell, played by Millie Bobby Brown, is a fan of Bernie's podcast and enlists her friend Josh, played by Julian Dennison, to investigate the Godzilla attacks. Apex CEO Walter Simmons recruits Nathan Lind, played by Alexander Skarsgård, who's a former Monarch scientist and Hollow Earth theorist, to guide the search for a power source into Hollow Earth. Now, it turns out that Godzilla can sense when other kaiju is on the move and has decided to assert his dominance, and he finds Kong in the ocean while they're on the way to the Hollow Earth entrance, and round one goes to Godzilla. The Monarch team airlifts Kong to the entrance after his first battle, and they make their way into Hollow Earth, and they found the power source, and Kong finds himself an axe that powers up using these external power sources. The remainder of the film sort of unveils how Apex Cybernetics have used the newly found energy source to power up Mechagodzilla, and it's this telepathically controlled by Zen Sarazawa, which is the son of the late Ishiru Sarazawa, through the neural networks from the skull of the severed Ghidorah head. And then we finally have this epic battle between these three monsters. Now, catching your breath there, guys. Save, what did you think?
I don't know about this film, to be honest. I have to say, I kind of felt like this was a pretty weak and predictable storyline. And I'm not a big Kong Godzilla type fan anyway. Not that I have any dislike for the franchise, but I don't have this sort of fanboy attitude towards it. So it wasn't going to hook me just on the fact that it was a smash and grab film. There was certain elements in this film, such as Kong knowing sign language, which I found overly predictable, but we'll touch on that a little bit later. And there was a few things in this film I think that I may not have got because I haven't seen other films in this sort of monsterverse recently, and I've either lost touch of them or maybe they weren't actually covered. But there was a few things that I sort of immediately thought, you know, how did Kong end up in containment? And having not seen the previous film at all recently, I sort of was at a loss coming into this film, and I felt that this film, given it was so far after the other films in this so-called monsterverse, it needed a little bit of a recap or something to actually invite audiences back in. Now, I actually liked the historical type of introduction in the credits. I thought that was great, but unfortunately, while it gave sort of a backstory to Kong and Godzilla individually as sort of historical artifacts throughout history, it didn't really help me with where this film was leading off in relation to other ones. So that was another mark against this film. And yeah, there's a couple of other little technical things like the big text location splash headers. There were so many of them, and often they're in quick succession. So it felt a little bit like the film was kicking you out of the universe and almost like you were watching a pseudo documentary that wasn't. So on the whole, as you know, sort of action smash films go, it's a little bit of fun, but I largely found it quite tedious. How about you?
Say, look, I'm not surprised you felt this way about this movie. And I think when it comes to these action films, we need to sort of change the lens we perceive them through. And it's important not to compare this franchise. And, you know, it is a franchise because it's essentially after three other movies and basically what I'll call a monsterverse. And, you know, it's important not to compare these franchises to existing franchises like Marvel, where one thing that this has going for it is it's not competing with other studios for monster verses, so they can sort of do what they want in their own time without the pressure that DC may have felt when Marvel assumed dominance in their respective fields. You know, performance anxiety can be a bit brutal. So, look, what do I think about this film? I didn't actually mind it. I think it gave us what the title was assuming, you know, Godzilla versus Kong. It didn't cheap out on who the true victor was. And as we said before, guys, spoiler alert, I do respect the film's decision to do this in this way. You know, like, we leave knowing who the dominant kaiju is, and it's obviously Godzilla. Well, it may not be obvious to some people, but yeah, it is Godzilla. And I think the film just serves action-packed on a platter. And this was an action movie through and through. If you paid to see it, you weren't there for the narrative. It reminded me of the new Mortal Kombat movie, you know, which was released earlier this year. But unlike that film, this had so much more production value.
Look, as a popcorn flick, yeah, okay, it was fine. And I'm not sure what I was actually expecting. But this felt a lot more like the likes of Pacific Rim than Godzilla or a Kong film. And I think that's what actually really threw me out of it. Because I guess in some way I was expecting this semi-grounded science fiction thing, a bit like some of the early Godzilla films in particular. Mm. But obviously this film didn't go off on that tangent. It stayed much more in this sort of smash and grab popcorn action flick with a relatively weak narrative. And as I said, I just didn't really know what to expect from this film.
Yeah. Look, I think when we compare this film to the original 1963 matchup, we didn't have a clear winner in that film, and it essentially ended up being a draw. So with this remake, director Adam Wingard sort of, you know, I felt like he was definitive in his vision. He had a clear direction on who was to win and why and where they fit into the world that the predecessors of these movies have created. And I personally like that. And I'm someone who prefers closure to such pivotal questions. Otherwise, it just drives me nuts. And the scene where Godzilla stands on the chest of Kong and growls down to make sure he knows he's been bested. Wow, man. Just simply amazing.
I have to admit, I wasn't actually sure how they were going to deal with the victor, or if they'd sort of cop out and make a everybody's a winner type of film and give them both an achievement award. I mean, this is the 21st century after all. But I guess to some extent they did. But as you say, Godzilla made his point. And like the end of Jurassic World, where T-Rex and Blue have this mutual agreement to halt their biological conflict for the greater good, so too Kong came to the party in the sense of more teeth to fight a common foe. So yeah, it wasn't like one character necessarily was completely down and out for the fight and a total KO. But yeah, there was, I guess, essentially a moral victory without it being a life or death victory.
Look, I think what I do like about how this film was sort of taken, or the narrative of the fight scenes between Kong and Godzilla was sort of translated on screen, was I don't think the director had a cop-out. Like, we saw each titan go for pound for pound. Mm. Some of them won due to certain powers or situations or land types that they were sort of fighting on, or land terrain, I should say, they were fighting on. So, you know, it was realistic in terms of, it was true to the character base that they had built up so much over these last three movies. And I really liked that.
Yeah, I think when you particularly really talk about terrain, that opening fight where it's on, well, it's on an ocean, but takes place kind of half and half on battleships. I was watching that and I went, yeah, okay, Kong's immediately at a massive deficit in this fight.
Oh, yeah.
But by the same
token, why he loses.
Yeah, absolutely. And this was the thing, though. They kind of did it in such a way that you went, okay, I can get on board with this being on water. He's got a couple of ships to hop around on. It did feel a little bit like that terrible film called Battleship a few years ago.
with Rihanna.
Yeah, with Rihanna and Liam Neeson. Oh, he must be desperate for a paycheck. But I did like the fact that they sort of played off these traits, and it wasn't all this land-based city destruction type of thing.
Look, you mentioned before Kong shows sign language, or it was predictable that he knew sign language. And I think we've seen real primates being taught how to sort of sign language in real life at zoos and, you know, like on YouTube and things like that. But like, it doesn't really come as a surprise to me. Like, while the Planet of the Apes films perfected on-screen primate communication to another level, you know, like, does this film attempt to capitalize on primate conversation for the sake of pushing the narrative forward? Yes, it does. But I felt like it wasn't too untasteful, in my opinion. And Gia, the little girl, you know, is the last of the tribe. And she, you know, like, it sort of tied into, the, you know, that she may possess the knowledge through her experience or through her lived experiences. And I thought, you know, I thought that was a good circle.
No, on this point, I concur with you. Yes, it was predictable. And it was no great surprise. And it did feel remarkably like a narrative tool of convenience. However, as you say, this is behavior that we have seen exhibited in real life. So I can forgive the writers this tool and let it pass. And Okay, I had a few other issues with the character of Jaya and, you know, why she happened to be in certain locations, because there was no sort of story grounding for her to be following along and traipsing around on these military ships and just dragging Kong off for no known reason, particularly at the point in time at which no one knew she could actually communicate with Kong. So it seemed a little bit too convenient for me from a writer's perspective. But yes, insofar as the predictability of sign language and communicating with Kong, I can let it pass.
I felt like Gia's presence on the ship was sort of shoehorned in by the writers just to push narrative forward, just to give the audience a great epic battle on these battleships in the middle of the ocean. But I think visually it was just fantastic. And it's actually funny because the Peter Jackson version of Kong had Adam as a assistant director, and then there was a person from the studio that made this film actually on set, and then I think Adam was sort of working on the sequel to that film after it didn't sort of, you know, do too well. And in that sequel, he had actually drafted this battleship scene, but because of overproduction and basically came down to dollars and cents, it didn't go anywhere. So it's just, I just found it fascinating that, you know, we come full circle and we get to see this scene play out like Adam had envisioned.
I actually wasn't aware of that, but that is interesting.
Yeah. So now to looking at the intro, like I think you mentioned that it was sort of nice and ties in with the Hollow Earth theory into the narrative. I think this Hollow Earth narrative or this Hollow Earth theory is actually an existing conspiracy theory that's actually present in real world. And we've also sort of seen it in like some novels in the past inspired by A Journey to the Center of the Earth. And I think there's an actual Hollow Earth book that's been released a couple of decades ago. So it's not like a new concept, but they've really tied it in with existing conspiracy theories. I'm pretty sure Elon Musk in a Twitter sort of said this film pays homage to all the conspiracy theorists out there. I am paraphrasing. It wasn't the exact tweet, but yeah.
That's right. In the next one, if we get another film, it might have something to do with the flat earth. You never know. But I have to admit, I did notice watching this film, I sort of went, oh, are we going to Journey of the Center Earth, or are we going into, you know, one of the Ice Age films and whatnot? It kind of had that feel, but I think a lot of these theories do come from similar places. So
yeah, exactly.
I can forgive it for that as well.
Yeah. All right. Now, look, we'll just briefly touch on the acting on this film. Oh, yeah, I know this is your favorite topic. Here we go. Take it away. I'll let you take it away.
Oh, no. I know what you want to start with. You start with it.
Look, basically, Julian Dennison's character is like absolutely bloody useless. He was shoehorned in purely because he was conveniently friends with Millie Bobby Brown's character, had a brother who had a van, and that was basically his role in this. Like, what the hell was he there for?
Yeah, this is going to be popular opinion, but I felt so much like this kid was cast to fill a studio diversity quota because he can't even act. Like, this isn't just a bad character. Oh. I just hated everything about it. It was just such a pointless entry into the narrative. As you say, all he did was stole a van and spilt some whiskey. Like, come on.
No, look, I do like Julia Dennison in other films, but in this film, I feel like they didn't utilize his potential. Like, Millie Bobby Brown's character had so much more, I'm not going to say depth, but, you know, I felt like her character had a massive shadow over everybody else.
Look, in all fairness to Julian, I think all the characters in this film were pretty shambolic. I mean, I was even disappointed with Millie Bobby Brown in this film. And it wasn't so much her execution. I think it was just a rubbish role. And, you know, I foresee this being a role that she might even regret in years to come, as it felt like a sidestep role and not even a career-defining role. And
well, she should. She should. It was disgusting.
It was. And I just wonder why people take on some of these roles, because surely they read these scripts and be like, maybe not. And particularly given we know she's quite capable of doing things. She's an intelligent young actress. She's got very good screen presence. And then she comes out and does this F-grade film. I was surprised. I was genuinely surprised.
Look, I don't think it was an F-grade film for me. But look, yes, you're right. Millie Bobby Brown has stunned us in Stranger Things. And then in the new a Netflix remake or adaptation of Sherlock Holmes, Enola Holmes,
yeah,
you know, she has this charismatic detective presence. You know, it's very like quirky slash flamboyant persona to her. Mm. And I think that's, you know, like that just shows her range. But then this film, yes, you're right, man. It's a sidestep. And it wasn't even like a sidestep in the right direction. It's like she could have brought more to this role, but
absolutely,
it was annoying.
and this is the thing, like, if she wanted to do an action flick and she wanted to do something like a young Tomb Raider sort of role, or a young Lara Croft or something, I mean, maybe not exactly that, but that type of role where it demands more of the actress and it's an interesting character, then great, good luck to her. But this just felt like a paycheck for everyone involved.
Now, speaking of super annoying, Bernie Hayes. Man, Brian Tyree Henry. Brother. Look, I'm sure you meant well, and I don't know if it was your fault or if it was the director's or if it was the writing, but man, you felt like you were on crack. Like, I was just getting nauseated watching you on screen. Like, it was just like, man, just shut the hell up.
Yeah, this was a character that felt like he was intelligent, or at least being written to be intelligent in the script, and then either the director, the actor, or someone along the way went, can we play him like a moron that just happens to get it right?
Yeah.
And I hate characters like that.
No,
there's no need for them. They're playing to such a dim-witted audience. Keep them smart. Elevate your content. Just because you want to have a film that's constantly blowing stuff up doesn't mean everyone involved needs to be an inept idiot that just gets lucky.
Look, I think this is a lesson for the studios. Your audiences are smarter and they demand more. Stop downgrading our intelligence by having unintelligible characters like this that you think that we can relate to. My God, please.
It's like bumbling Batman films. Stupid. Take a serious Batman film like Dark Knight. People love it. People want this serious, slightly more highbrow action, still a popcorn flick type thing. But we get served this and we just go, really? This might have been acceptable in 1993, but it's not going to fly now.
No, and you're right. Look, maybe for that era, it would have worked, but now we expect so much more. The benchmark has been set by great directors, great writers, great actors, and, you know, we just demand more from character depth. So, guys, you've got to pull up your socks in the studios or whoever's making these executive decisions.
Yeah, because it feels very much like, to me, a whole bunch of these films are still thought of in the case of, if we make the special effects look really good, then people will like it anyway. And I think, no, it's about more than just the special effects. Yes, we demand really good, realistic-looking special effects, but we demand a wonderful story that goes with it as well.
Look, I think they would have gotten away with this film because, like, personally for me, I don't think narrative-wise it was, you know, so much, and the actors didn't have, like, a gigantic role in the context of where the series is headed. But having said that, just because you make your budget or more than your budget back in returns, it doesn't mean you can't elevate your films to another level. And I think that's what mise-en-scene is saying to you guys, that you can have blockbuster films with also great dialogue.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Now, look, normally we like look into sort of themes, but in this particular film, we're going to look at fun facts and interrelated narrative lore. So I might kick this section off and just sort of like look at the previous films in the series and sort of how they fare up to this film or how they lead into this.
Go for it.
And when I see a movie like this, I often sort of tend to look back on the series and see how it was sort of set up. And it's interesting to note that in the original Godzilla, that there was only 10 minutes of screen time for the monster to be on screen. And look, I think the film was sort of like set up in that way to, you know, to show the impact of the cover-up and the repercussions on human lives. And bloody Bryan Cranston is, you know, he's in that movie. And that film's like littered with stars at the peak of their careers. And it was such a sort of like a really good origin film for the franchise. And I really enjoyed it. Now, the second film sort of ramped up the severity of the other kaiju, you know, like that Godzilla takes on, you know, while it was also jam-packed. And I felt like it skipped sort of films in the series. Look, I'm about to commit the cardinal sin here, say, which I warned you not to commit before, which is basically comparing franchises. But imagine if we got Iron Man 1 and then Iron Man 2, and then the next film like we get is Endgame or Civil War. You know, like the community and the character building that we've known and love ceases to exist. And I think this is where the problem lies. We don't have a lead creative vision leading these independent directors who are making these films, because I think Marvel has a habit of making films with independent directors and, you know, like not the same directors doing their consecutive movies. And that's exactly what happened here, which has worked fine. But I think one could argue this film could or should have come before Godzilla King of the Monsters. And, you know, like Godzilla vs. Kong, this particular movie continues this series with the tradition of moving the master narrative about the Monarch Project forward while letting each successive independent team of filmmakers do their own thing. But I just found that there was a bit of disconnect in the continuity, and it just sort of felt elevated at times for me.
This reminds me a little bit of Disney's abysmal efforts with Star Wars episodes 7-9. The overarching message is lost by self-interested writers and directors, and they ultimately just do a great disservice to the franchise, while it seems only trying to inflate their own egos. And equally, why, for the most part, the MCU, as you mentioned, was held together for a decade, because the writers and directors had a common goal with a clear vision of how they wanted to get there. And I was beginning to wonder whether this garbage was actually, you know, somehow related to Pacific Rim, because such was the disconnect with its own supposed universe. And I was beginning to wonder if this was even meant to cross into other franchises, because it didn't feel like it was holding its own in its own narrative universe. And I felt like while I was watching this, as you said, there was this huge disconnect between the films that came before it and whether they were perhaps in the wrong order, and the monarch element sort of seems to drop in, but it's inconsistent. And I think you're right. I think it is about inconsistency on the production side of things in the background, and too many people trying to go too many different directions, trying to get to a unique end goal, but no one bothered to tell each other what that goal actually is.
Yeah. Look, I am pretty sure that Adam in an interview sort of mentions that he's left it open. You know, he didn't include a post-credit scene purely because of the fact that he didn't want to sort of box in other potential directors into a particular narrative arc or where to sort of head. And we've seen this in Star Wars as well in Episode 8, where this little kid at the very end of the film, you know, has no sort of a Jedi training, and he ends up being able to sort of wield the Force, and this completely like throws away the entire lore and the world building that sort of like transpired leading up to this point, because one director decided to do something crazy. And then in the next film, they completely ignore that aspect of like the world building, and it's like, well, that didn't really happen.
Yeah.
And I think that's what, you know, like, it's, yeah.
And I think this is probably the same thing that's going wrong completely with the DC universe. There's too many people trying to do too many different things and nobody knows where they're going.
Yeah.
And I think if studios want franchises and they want those franchises to be successful, then they need to sit down and say, right, here's where this franchise is going. This is the net result. Now, whoever directs it, there's your end goal. Don't care how you get there, but be consistent with what comes before you and make sure you get where we need to go.
Yeah.
And I think if they did that, they would solve so many of their problems, both in terms of the production of films and how they're going and where they're going, as well as the audience reception of these films, as to whether they're actually satisfied that the film has essentially checked the boxes that they're looking for, or whether it's just a total disaster, like most would argue episodes 7-9 of Star Wars were. Whereas the previous 6 films were a vision of one man executed by one man, and therefore it felt like it was one universe.
Yeah.
And likewise, the Marvel universe. Yes, it was executed by many people, but they all knew where they were going. So we look at the last decades of the MCU and go, yeah, it works.
Yeah.
Whereas you get 2 films into a DC film or 2 films into the MonsterVerse here, and it's just a mess.
Yeah, that's right. Now, look, I mentioned post-credit scene. I think Adam said that he did have one, or like they did do one, but they ended up incorporating it into the movie. And I think it's a scene of Kong in Hollow Earth sort of pounding his chest and saying, hey, I'm home. This is my domain now. Godzilla rules up at the top and I rule at the bottom, or in the middle, I should say. And so I think that's the post-credit scene. I think Adam did the right thing by not shoehorning other directors into a potential stalemate.
I agree. And I think the other thing is too, that not every film needs a post-credit scene. As much as we like them, they're not necessary. And I think if you have wrapped up the film itself properly, then it leaves enough things open for anyone else to do what they want without, as you say, boxing any future people in.
So say, what are some things that you didn't really like about this film? Or what didn't work for you?
Look, there was a couple of really daft things in particular, and one of them was the security that you could breach with a piece of metal and a tipple of whiskey. And things like that, I just went, how lazy are the writers?
Yeah.
I mean, okay, you've dumbed down all the characters so much that the only way you can write a solution is for them to do something even stupider. And things like that really annoyed me, because it is just lazy writing and poor execution of character development. And I think if that's going to make it all the way to the net result on the screen, then you really can't trust what else actually happens in the film. So I think things like that actually take away and detract a lot from the film. I won't go into a bunch of my other gripes, but that was a big one. There were a few things I liked, likewise on the tech front, like the maglev tubes and stuff. I've got an affinity for maglev tubes, have done my whole life for some reason. But yeah, anyway, I won't go too deep.
Right. Look, I'm going to have to agree with you here. And I think the biggest problem with this film, and we've discussed this time and time again now already, but the humans are the secondary characters of this film, right? And I think by the directors giving the humans equal screen time for a blockbuster film, it sort of takes away from what I personally came to see the film for. I basically came here to see it, you know, like to go 16 rounds.
title fight. Yeah, it's funny actually you mentioned that, because I looked at otherwise that this story could have been executed. And I think, yes, in large part, you could have done away with all of the terrible human characters in this film. You could have kept Kong, you could have kept Godzilla, and they mostly could have gone about and done what they did. But I think if you just kept the character of Jaya, perhaps, and that she was basically Kong's human ally and he kept coming back to her to discuss what was going on in the world, I think that would have been enough, even if you just subtitled her part of the film.
Mm.
I don't think we needed the rest of the characters. They didn't contribute anything. And the only meaningful relationship Kong actually had with humanity was the character of Jaya.
Well, look, I think the only reason why the human characters are there are for pure exposition and to tell the audiences where the narrative is going, right? That's basically what their role is in these monster movies. But speaking of Gia and her relationship with Kong and like what these monsters mean, I did find this a little link between global warming and sort of how humans have sort of continually messed up at home. In this Matt Zoller Certs article, he draws some interesting parallels to, you know, some of these themes that we've deciphered before on global warming and like what I just said, how humans have sort of messed up at home and how this has been like a recurring theme in some of these movies that we've sort of talked on this season and last season as well. And Matt, in his article, he breaks down the origins of, for those who missed it, where these giant creatures sort of come from and like where they originate from. So they're basically older than dinosaurs and have lived on this Earth's surface, feeding on like these residual radiation from the Big Bang, and then moved inside as the energy embedded hibernating, you know, in this hollow Earth, until one day humans like disturb their slumber with this nuclear testing, strip mining, and, you know, just basically treating this Earth like a toilet. And Matt goes on to further state that the premise was fused to a philosophy that stayed consistent from film to film. And I think I agree with him here, which is basically that the kaijus don't hate us. They don't even, you know, mean us harm. If they do, you know, it's just sort of snack on us from time to time. They're just animals jockeying, you know, for dominance. Like, basically, they're trying to be the apex predators. And it's just a battle for, like, territory and for dominance and to exert power. And that's what Kong versus Godzilla is. It's, hey, this is my domain. I'm the king. Watch yourself. As long as you know what the hell's going on here.
It reminds me of that line that, you know, an ant has no quarrel with a boot.
Yeah.
And I think that's really the case. You know, the kaiju to humans are essentially what humans are to ants.
I was going
to
say, having said that, what's the future for this franchise?
Narrative-wise, I'm not sure I can really talk on that because I don't know enough about the universes respectively, be them Godzilla or Kong. However, I think from a fiscal or studio perspective, they're more than likely going to pull the pin and say, you know what, we're not going to make another film.
Whoa.
At least that's what I hope.
Oh, okay, okay. Interesting perspective.
Unless they make a really interesting story out of it, I don't think it's got enough energy to just do another explosions and smash film.
Right. Okay, I'm going to have to disagree with you here, mate. I think the film sort of dropped a lot of Easter eggs that allow future directors to sort of do their own thing, where we see the humans creating and growing their own titans to sort of like to fight the Mechagodzilla. And this is sort of in reference to the old kaiju like Gesasora and Biorante. And, you know, like they're meant to be like the Thanos of the monster universe, so to speak. And I think it's going to be interesting to see if they go down that pathway. Now, I know that there are some extraterrestrial sort of titans in space or some sort of alien ones that sort of come down to Earth, and it gets all very, like, complex, I should say. Another little Easter egg is that one thing to note is when we see the Skullcrawlers come out of their confinement, they said that this is release 1 of 10, which raises the question, are the other 10 all Skullcrawlers or are they just different monsters?
Mm.
And then we've got the potential of exploring Kong's family and ancestors in Hollow Earth. We see a lot of relics and drops of all history, you know, like these great big monuments that have been built. And now, like, Kong's back down there. So there's so much potential there as well. So in my personal opinion, they can go anywhere, but this is sort of like the three directions where I will sort of hedge my bet.
Yeah, but see, this is my problem. I wouldn't mind if they, as I said, came out with a good story, and if it was, you know, Kong down in his new little world that somehow has sunlight and whatnot, then great. I think you could do an interesting sort of historical artifact type of film. I think that would be fascinating, and we'd get a whole aspect of Kong that we've never really seen before, because we seldom, if ever, to my memory, have actually seen his family and what that, I guess, ancient empire was like from a bygone era. And I think that would be interesting. Just do away with the rubbish human characters or have some sort of primitive form of them and just move forward with that. However, what I'm worried will happen is that, like a Michael Bay film, the studios will be like, oh, we need more explosions and more violence. And we'll just end up with another crap film like Pacific Rim Uprising, where the only way for the films to continue is an escalation of monsters and bigger and badder and more explosions. And I think that just makes for a really, really weak story. And if they do that, if they go down that path of escalation, then where does it end? Because essentially, like the Pacific Rim stories, you can only go so big before you have to go home. Mm. And I'm worried that now that they've already essentially done the double apex Godzilla vs. Kong, it's either going to be bigger, bigger, bit like we alluded to with the Mecha Godzilla, in which case they had to sort of buddy up, or we just essentially have a rehash of what we've just had. And I don't think we need that.
No. No. Look, if the studios want more explosions, they're going to have to fork out more money. I think that's what it comes down to. And I think that's what Adam talks about in his interviews as well, that some of these scenes, the expense versus explosion ratio per scene, it depends on what scene they're doing. Because a 1 minute scene can cost us just as much as a 5 minute action scene. It just all depends on what's involved and how intricate these scenes are. So look, it's up to the studios, but yeah, look, I would like to see another film in the franchise, but if they can incorporate better narrative with the same action-packed monsters.
Well, it's yet to be seen, I guess. If they want my opinion and my creative input, they can call me. I think I've got some good ideas for a new one coming from outside of this monster universe, but that's unlikely to happen, so we shall see what happens.
Look, you heard it here first, Universal. Contact Xavier from Mise en Scène and we will sort you out for your next script. Having said that, let's move on to cinematography and the score save. Take it away. I know you don't have much to say because there's not much to sort of brag about here.
No, there wasn't much to brag about here, and some of it was just remarkably cliche or just ripped from other films. One of the big ones was, you know, I was waiting for the Harry Potter red and blue power clash, you know, the flames and the titans coming together. And hey, presto, we got it. It was no surprise there. And the effects were much the same. The powers met in the middle and kablamo. Whoopee-doo for that. We've seen it before.
I like the kaiju fight from the second Godzilla movie. But like I said before, guys, I really thought that this film should have been the predecessor to that previous film. So, look, I didn't mind the action. I absolutely loved it in terms of the visual spectacle between Godzilla and Kong. Action nerds, action fans would have really got their pants wet over it. But I did like the primary neon colors. It was sort of, you know, paying homage to previous films. And I also do like when Kong shoves at the end of the axe down Godzilla's throat. I think that was homage to one of the 1960s films where he shoves the tree down Godzilla. I thought that was pretty funny, but I think all in all, a visual spectacular, but nothing else.
Well, can I just say too, on that visual front, the shot where they go into Hollow Earth and they reverse gravity in the little ship and it sort of falls down behind the mountain and whatnot, that, and I would have to watch these side by side, but that felt pretty much like a direct shot-for-shot ripoff from Star Trek Beyond when they launched the old spaceship off the edge of the mountain.
Some say ripoff, say others say homage.
Yeah, I'm going for a ripoff.
Look, I think the director may have been a fan.
Well, good luck to him, but it's like, come on, guys. You're doing the entire thing with special effects. You can do something a little bit different.
On that note, let's wrap this film up, say.
Okay, well, for me, this film was complete and utter garbage. It wasn't even a B-grade film. As I said earlier, I reckon this was nearer an F-grade film. Not that any of the cast of this film were particularly noteworthy, but I'd expect a little bit better than what we got. And as I've said earlier, I was surprised Millie Bobby Brown had actually stooped to such levels in her career already. Now, this is an agonizingly protracted and disparate universe that they've tried to build, and I'm of the opinion that it could be considerably better if they were less caught up on the whole Michael Bay Transformers style, let's blow stuff up aspect of the narrative, and actually gave us something meaningful through the narrative of Beasts and Legends. Now, there's been flavors of it in the past, and I'd rather see more of that historical context in the future, with Monarch actually being something interesting rather than being these sloppy, insidious baddies with too much money and not enough sense. So I'm going to be particularly brutal on this film, and I'm only going to give this film a 2 out of 10.
Ooh, that's got to hurt, guys. That's got to hurt. Look, I just want to say, Millie Bobby Brown, we love you. We love Stranger Things. We just didn't love you in this film.
Yeah, absolutely.
Having said that, look, this film for me wasn't too bad in terms of action packed. I've got nothing new to add on that I haven't already said about how I feel about this film. Look, Zabe, I'm going to give this film two separate ratings, one for the action packed film that it is and the other for the narrative foundations that this film lacked. So I'm going to give this film a surprising 6.8 for the action and a 5 out of 10 for the narrative. So I don't even know if I want to average it out. I'm happy with just these two separate scores. But if I was to average it out, it might be closer to a 6.3 or 4.
I would have said averaged out. That's more like a 5.7. But anyway,
maybe.
Fair enough. Well, that's all from us, folks. And next week, in honor of Alan recently becoming a father, we're going back to Disney and having a look at the new Cruella film. But until then, we hope you've enjoyed another episode from us. And remember, if you're not already, give us a follow on Instagram and Facebook and recommend us to your friends and family. However, until next week, goodbye from us.
Goodbye all, and we'll see you all next week.